Hi, this is Barry Liston, Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science and Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. Many reporters look at polls and make very straightforward inferences from polling data. In today's segment, we talk to Alan Lichtman, a professor of history at American University. Professor Lichtman is the author of The Keys to the White House, and he has used more sophisticated quantitative methods to forecast the outcome of American elections. With the midterm elections soon to take place in the U.S. and President Obama's future in many ways at stake, we're talking with him today, just 3 weeks before Election Day. Professor Lichtman, welcome to The Science of Better.
Thank you so much.
There was an Alfred Hitchcock movie in which a character portentously asks, "What are the 39 steps?" You created a system called the 13 Keys to forecast the outcome of presidential elections. So let me ask, what are the 13 Keys?
The 13 Keys are a system for forecasting the popular vote outcome of presidential elections. They're a national system, so they can't do individual states. And the keys are based upon the proposition that 90% of what is written and said about presidential elections is wrong. This conventional wisdom is usually based on the horse race theory, and everything in America is a sports metaphor, the horse race theory of elections, in which candidates shoot ahead or fall behind depending on what happens on the campaign trail. According to the keys to the White House, the campaign is largely irrelevant. That what determines the outcome of a presidential election takes place even before the campaign even begins. Essentially, presidential elections are referenda up or down upon the performance of the party holding the White House. If that performance is solid, that party will get 4 more years. If not, they'll be tossed out and the challenging party wins. And the 13 keys are simply a series of true-false questions designed to gauge whether the political environment indeed favors the election, re-election of the party in power or the re-election of the challenging party. If 6 or more of the 13 keys go against the party in the White House, they lose. If fewer than 6 go against the party in power, they win. This system held retrospectively from 1860 to 1980. I created it in 1981 in collaboration with the great Soviet geophysicist, then Soviet, Volodya Kylas-Borok, and it has prospectively correctly anticipated, usually well ahead of time, the results of the last 7 elections in a row since 1984.
And how did you develop the keys with him? I understand his work was in predicting earthquakes, which is a rather interesting match.
Yeah, it was a very strange match. We met, of course, totally by accident. We were both Sherman Fairchild visiting scholars at the California Institute of Technology in 1981. And we had dinner. And, of course, over dinner, when you meet a stranger in an academic setting, the question is always, what do you do? And I told Volodya that I was a quantitative historian. I looked at mathematics to understand patterns in American society and American politics. And he looked at me and he said, I do same thing. And I said, what do you mean you do same thing? You're a geophysicist. He said, geophysicists do the same thing. We look at mathematically patterns in the history of the Earth to understand geophysics. And I said, that's nice, happy to meet you, goodbye. And he said, wait. And I said, why? And he said, we are going to collaborate. And I said, no, we're not. Earthquakes may be a big deal here in Southern California, in L.A. I got to go back to Washington, D.C., where nobody cares. And he said, no, we're not collaborating on earthquakes. We're collaborating on political prediction. He said he always wanted to apply the methods of earthquake prediction to politics, but of course in the Soviet Union, it's supreme leader or off with your head. And I thought at this point, you know, the guy was nuts or maybe KGB when there really was a KGB, but I was an historian. I had nothing to hide. And so we began this collaboration. And it struck me as not so strange to steal from geophysics. After all, everything we know about politics is stolen from geophysics. Tremors of political change, seismic movements of the voters, volcanic elections. And so what we did was we reconceptualized elections, presidential elections, in geophysical terms, not looking at Carter versus Reagan, Republicans versus Democrats, conservatives versus liberals, but stability, the party holding the White House retains the White House, and upheaval, the party holding the White House is turned out. And we looked historically at lots and lots of indicators of incumbent party strength and performance and came up with the 13 keys and the 6-key decision rule.
With that in mind, could you run down the 13 keys for us one by one, or if you'd like?
Absolutely. No, I've got them. Yeah. No, they all count equally. They're all completely unweighted. They all count for one. And the first four keys I call the political keys. They gauge the strength and unity of the party holding the White House. The first key is called incumbent party mandate, and it looks at whether the party holds more seats in the U.S. House after its midterm election than it did after the previous midterm election. Second one I call the contest key. There is no serious contest for the incumbent party nomination. And by the way, all the keys are phrased. So an answer of true favors the party in power, six falses and they're out. Key three, incumbency. The incumbent party candidate is the sitting president. Key four, third party. There is no significant third party or independent campaign defined as one likely to get at least 5% of the popular vote. Key five, short-term economy. The economy is not in recession during the election campaign. Key six, long-term economy. Real annual per capita growth during the term at least equals the mean growth during the previous two terms. Policy change. The incumbent administration achieves major changes in national policy. Key eight, social unrest. There is no sustained social unrest during the term. Key nine, scandal. The incumbent administration is untainted by major scandal. Key 10, foreign or military failure. The administration suffers no major failure abroad. Key 11, foreign or military success. The administration achieves a major success abroad. Key 12, incumbent charisma. The incumbent party candidate is charismatic or a national hero. And finally, key 13, the only key that has anything to do with the challenging party, and that is the challenging party candidate is not charismatic or a national hero.
All right, given the 13 keys, I wanted to circle back to something we were talking about before. In most pre-election coverage, the focus is on public opinion. Your keys contain almost no reference to public opinion. How did you come to break from the kind of polling that the mass media and presidents like Bill Clinton have relied on so much? And why are you relying on what some might regard as an ideal measure, the president's success at governance?
Well, first, looking historically from 1981 when I developed the keys, I realized polls were often way off the mark. Of course, there is the well-known example of Harry Truman, who was behind in all the polls and came on to win. But even in 1952, 4 years later, when Eisenhower had his huge landslide victory, the polls were somewhat inconclusive. The polls absolutely missed Reagan's big landslide in 1980, calling a very close election that could have gone either way, and the polls were of no help at all in such really tight elections like 1960 and 1968. Secondly, I thought about elections even before there was polling. I particularly thought about the election of 1896, when Democrat William Jennings Bryan ran against Republican William McKinley. It was the Great Depression of the 1890s, but Bryan broke with every policy of the incumbent Cleveland administration, and McKinley was actually much closer in policies to the incumbent, but Bryan still lost, the challenger still won, because regardless of his ideology, regardless of his position, the incumbent party suffers the blame or the benefits from the current situation. I also looked for inspiration to a quote from Herbert Hoover, a guy who should know, who said, the president gets the credit for the sunshine and the blame for the rain. So it's essentially a performance-based, not an ideologically-based theory.
You boast a perfect record with, I assume, an asterisk in the year 2000 when Gore and Bush essentially tied. You've done this already, but tell us again your analysis. Review for us what your analysis showed historically about past presidential elections, how you tested your methods, so to speak.
Yes.
And then turning around after you've developed your methods based on history and how you began forecasting based on your developed methods.
Well, what we first did was we decided we were going to look at every American presidential election from 1860 to 1980. This was in 1981 when we did our work. And we started in 1860 because that was the first presidential election under the modern Republican Democratic system where you had at least a four-year history of Republicans beating Democrats. And we decided we would try to figure out whether or not you could predict elections based primarily on performance and party strength indicators for the party in power without any reference to the issues or to the ideologies or anything at all except one factor relating to the challenging party. And as I said, we had lots of different factors, and we used the methodology of pattern recognition, which is quite different from multiple regression-based methods that most forecasters use. We were not trying to come up with an equation that relates percentage of the vote for the party in power to factors like changes in public opinion polls, movements of the economy, unemployment. And the reason we didn't do that is we believed those systems don't work, and we had seen them failing because there isn't fixed relationships over time between these variables. So we developed a more flexible system, an index system, which didn't require you to form an equation, didn't require you to figure out some kind of stable relationship over time quantitatively, but simply looked at the kinds of factors that historically determined outcomes of elections and how many negative factors it took historically for the party in power to lose. Any six keys against the party in power, they're a predicted loser. It doesn't matter which six keys. It's a purely nonlinear system, so we don't have to make the mistake of traditional forecasters of assuming fixed and stable equations over time.
Now we've got your methods in place. Why don't we turn to the current political atmosphere and the current administration?
Sure.
Earlier this year, at the time when healthcare passed Congress, you wrote that the 13 keys pointed to President Obama winning a second term.
Correct.
His polling numbers are now relatively low. Have you revised your prediction?
I have not at all revised my predictions. And those predictions, by the way, took into account that he would lose the incumbent party mandate key. I knew that was going to happen. Republicans were going to make big gains in the House. But if you look at the keys, nomination contest. Obama's not going to be seriously contested. He's the sitting president. There's no third party on the horizon like the Ross-Perot situation. Short-term economy was kind of the key. One of the presumptions of my prediction was that the recession wouldn't last forever, that, in fact, 2 years from now, the economy would be picking up. If that doesn't happen, that could jeopardize the prediction, although not entirely thwarted. Other factors. Long-term economy, I counted against him. Policy change, he's already achieved major policy change. Social unrest, this isn't the 60s, it's not the Reconstruction period. The country is not in danger of unraveling, despite the Tea Party. They're a pretty peaceful lot. Scandal, so far the administration's been squeaky clean. Foreign failure, there's been no huge foreign failure on his watch. Military success, foreign success, I count that against him. Incumbent charisma is a close call. I think he's kind of lost his charisma. But challenger charisma, there's no one out there with the kind of charisma that Ronald Reagan had. Sarah Palin has a certain charisma, but it turns off as many voters as it turns on. So you look at the bigger picture and forget his poll numbers, things are looking pretty good for Barack Obama. And don't forget, Ronald Reagan took big losses in 1982 and had low poll ratings and lost the party mandate key and came back to win in 1984. Bill Clinton had low poll numbers in 1994, lost the midterm elections, came back to win in 1996. Same thing with Harry Truman in 1946, came back to win in 1948. So we can really overestimate approval ratings early and the effects of midterm elections. They're just one of 13 factors.
There's a lot of grumbling in the Democratic Party itself. Do you think this grumbling might lead to the kind of challenge for the primary that Ted Kennedy gave to President Carter?
I'd be absolutely shocked. Hopefully the Democratic Party has learned something from the Ted Kennedy challenge, which is it's almost impossible to unseat in the primaries a sitting president, and all you do is undermine your party. Plus, I don't see, there's no Ted Kennedy there. There's no there right now in the Democratic Party. There's no one with the stature of Ted Kennedy except Hillary Clinton, and that would be madness for her to come out of the Obama administration and then challenge him. So no, I don't see that scenario opening up.
Related to another key, Obamacare, as his critics call his health care policy, has high negatives even though it qualifies for your key on significant social legislation.
Yes.
Do you think this is still a valid key or a valid interpretation of your key putting it on his side?
Absolutely. I think it really helps for the party in power to have a record to run on, even if that record is controversial. And by the way, the polls have improved on Obamacare. It used to be that, you know, a fairly substantial majority were against it, but now it's about 50-50, and that's also skewed by the fact that, you know, in a lot of states that Obama doesn't need and has no hope to win, like Texas and Utah, the numbers are much, much more negative. And I think over time, too, these things can change. One of the fallacies of our politics that I've tried to change with the keys is kind of instant reaction. You know, we don't look at the longer-term picture. We tend to react to yesterday's polls and yesterday's headlines, and hopefully the keys have suggested that that's just a major mistake.
We were talking before about the key dealing with the charisma of challengers to the president. I think many would agree that Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell is not charismatic, but how do you measure the charisma of a Mitt Romney compared to Ronald Reagan? Is it a gut measure?
Well, in part it's a gut measure, and in part, you know, they poll on this. There's a lot of polling on the, you know, the approval rating of these candidates, whether they are, you know, charismatic. And it's not a difficult key to call because so few candidates and presidents have qualified. And I don't think you and I would disagree that if you look at, you know, the last 100 years of history, it's pretty easy to figure out who they were. Franklin Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, the national hero, John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan. You got to come into that, you know, high realm, and clearly nobody on the Republican side right now comes close. That could change, but these are pretty well-known figures, Mitt Romney, Sarah Palin, Mike Huckabee. I don't think they're suddenly going to turn into John F. Kennedy or Ronald Reagan.
Question before we move on. Are the 13 keys being used at all by either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party? Is it being used other than by historians or the press?
Well, you bet. Let me give you a couple of stories. When I first came out with the keys, you know, in 1981, I published my first article in April of 1982 predicting that Ronald Reagan would be reelected. And I'm sitting in my office, and one of the first phone calls I get is, guess who? Lee Atwater, the political director of the Ronald Reagan White House.
Now, he was quite a presence.
He was an amazing, he was, you know, Karl Rove before there was a Karl Rove. You know,
and I really think the pioneered. Two of them knew one another, and he had an influence on a Karl Rove.
Absolutely. You know, he was ruthless and brilliant. And he called me into the White House, and I went to the White House. And, you know, I wasn't a right-wing Republican, so I felt a little uneasy, but immediately Atwater put me at my ease, and we became friends eventually. And he asked me about, you know, Kennedy and Nixon and Harry Truman coming from behind and all of those elections. And finally, at the end of the day, we got down to the question that he really wanted to ask me. What would happen if Ronald Reagan did not run again in 1984? And we looked at the keys, and we saw the Republicans would go from a sure victory to a sure defeat. A nomination contest. Without the Gipper, there would have been a big nomination contest. Incumbency. He's not the incumbent president, wouldn't be running. Charisma. Then, you know, George Bush and that crew, they didn't have anyone with the charisma. So it was, you know, quite clear that they had to run Ronald Reagan, which was not a foregone conclusion at that time. You know, the guy was getting on in years, was in his 70s. Second time I know this was used was when I first came out with my book on this in 1990, The 13 Keys to the Presidency, which was being read, of course, in 1991. And remember, at that time, everybody thought George H.W. Bush was absolutely absolutely invincible. Every Democrat.
You know, I think there's a lesson there, because certainly after winning the Gulf War, the press expressed certainty, as you say.
Right, and every well-known Democrat was getting out of that race. Mario Cuomo, Al Gore, Ted Kennedy. But I got a call from a woman named Kay Goss, who, of course, was special assistant to Governor Bill Clinton in Arkansas. And Kay calls me and says, are you really serious that George Bush can be beaten in 1992? Because I wrote in my book, forget the polls, forget the pundits. Based on history, Bush looks more like a Carter than a Reagan. And I said, you bet your life. I sent Bill Clinton a copy of my book and a memo on why George Bush was going to lose in 1992, and the rest is history.
That's actually quite fascinating. Turning from history to the current political situation, I thought we would take a look at the midterm elections.
Absolutely.
Are you focusing on any of the senatorial elections?
Yeah, I'm focusing pretty closely, but with no special expertise. I don't have, you know, the same kind of track record and as successful a system for midterm elections as I do for the presidential elections. So I'm happy to give you my opinions.
Go right ahead.
What I believe is going to happen is the Republicans are going to take the House and the Democrats will narrowly retain the Senate, maybe even by just 50 votes, making, of course, the Vice President Joe Biden the tiebreaker. And I think the critical factor was Delaware, where the establishment Republican was 15 points ahead. He was beaten by a Tea Party Republican. And the result is the Democrats are now 15 points ahead. And Delaware may prove to be the Achilles heel for the Republican efforts to win back the Senate.
Although the Tea Party has shown greater strength in some of the other states like Nevada and I believe Kentucky also with Rand Paul.
Yeah, but those states were also absolute lock solid for the Republicans. Harry Reid was gone. The Republicans were way ahead in Kentucky, but now both of those states are in play because of the Tea Party nominees.
The House
side. Let me finish the thought.
Sure.
So the Tea Party has very much energized the Republican Party and very much been a positive in that sense, but in the narrow sense of, you know, this particular election and who's going to control the Senate, they probably have hurt the Republican Party.
Are there any important indicators in terms of House elections that you're examining?
Well, the most important indicator is always the state of the economy. And historically, given this kind of economy, the party in power is going to take some major losses. The other factor that's going on here, I think, is the anger. The other thing we know about midterm elections is they're very low turnout elections, much lower than presidential elections. So those who might have been motivated to come out and vote in a presidential election and support the president will not be present in the midterm elections, but those who are present in the midterm elections are the angry voters, those who want to send a message to the White House.
We only have time for one more question. The 2010 census is expected to change the number of districts in states like Texas, which will likely gain,
yes,
and New York, which will likely lose.
Correct.
In that light, how important are state races for governor and for control of state legislatures?
I can't tell you how important these lower profile races that no one's paying attention to really are, because not only will there be some shifting around of districts from one state to another, but something even more important is going on. That is, every congressional district, every state legislative district, every city council and county council district will be redrawn. And the drawing of those districts can have a dramatic effect on who wins those elections. And so who controls the governorship and who controls the state legislatures will have an enormous impact on who gets to draw the lines starting next year.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor Alan Liftman of American University. Professor, thank you for joining us.
My great pleasure.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on punching those numbers.